pleasure and joy to welcome Abdul Latif Abdallah here to Zetten Aw, and we are very happy he's spending a week here with us. And well, for many of you, I think I hardly need to mention details, achievements of his life, but I do want to flag up a few things only before we hear about his own life from Abdul Latif Abdallah himself. He's one of the most gifted and most famous Swahili poets alive. He's been also carving a life as a political activist dedicated to social justice for quite a long time out of his own country, outside of Kenya, which due to circumstances that we'll be talking and hearing about. In terms of his family background, he's from an old established family of the Swahili Kilindini, if I'm not mistaken, where there's been a tradition of intellectual scholarships. There are poets and healers and religious scholars in the family. So in a sense, he's also part of that tradition, keeping it alive in his own personal way. He's now, for the last 12 years or so, been a lecturer in Kiswahili at the University of Leipzig. And if we look before that, he's been spending over a decade, I think, in London. After spending quite some time in Tanzania, having left Kenya. So I'm going to roll it up from the other side now. It was a key event of his life was to be imprisoned after having written a political pamphlet against the Kenyatta regime at the end of 1968, where he was protesting against dictatorial tendencies of the Kenyatta regime, which had changed its course and suppressed political diversity. And for that pamphlet, Kenya Twendawapi, Kenya where we running, he was imprisoned and put in isolation imprisonment for 3 years. And it is there where his most famous collection of poetry, Sauti Yaziki, Voice of Agony, where these poems were written in prison and published some years after, in 1973, with Oxford University Press. So this is his most well-known and celebrated collection of poems. There are others, like the epic poem of Adam and Eve, Utensia Wamaisha Adam Hawa, and he's also edited several collections of poems. He's been involved in quite a lot of research on Swahili language and literature. And I also want to mention, because I don't know whether all of us have that on cards, also his art of translation. He's, for instance, translated Ayi Kwe Ama's well-known novel, The Beautiful Ones Are Not Yet Born, into Swahili. So this is just picking up on some of the published achievements. But I do want to mention also, and I've found out a bit more of these last 2 days, that there's actually a lot of unpublished works written, completed, some perhaps not completed, but which all of us and many more would like to hear about and later on also see. So perhaps we will hear a little bit more about this also today, about poetry in the making, about essays, political and literary ones. So basically, I just want to close this introduction by saying thank you once again. Welcome, Sonia. Thank you once again. So thank you for spending a week with us here and for being available to us. And I'm handing over the word to you in the hope that we'll continue our, well, by now long-lasting friendly working relationships for quite some time to go also. So thank you again. And Yes, we now have the opportunity to listen for 20 minutes, half an hour to aspects of your life, and then there's open time for questions.
At the outset, I must first thank the CEDEMO for having invited me here to spend a week at this institution. And I also thank you so much for having taken time to come and listen to me. You must have had more worthwhile things to do, but you decided to come here. I thank you so much for it. This is a great honor for me. my task, I've been told that, as you have heard, that I'm supposed to be talking to you for about 20 to 30 minutes. And Banakai insisted that this is supposed to be an informal gathering and talk. So it has made my, in fact, task easier, since we'll just be like sitting over a cup of coffee and chatting. Now, I've been tasked to talk about, as you are informed, my political activism in post-independence Kenya and in my times in exile. Now, whenever I'm asked to come and talk about myself, I have difficulties because I'm not very good about talking about myself. It's very difficult for me. But I think, well, I'll try my best, but I think the most and the most important part, I think, of this afternoon will be perhaps during the question and answer session and the discussion. I think there are then perhaps things which perhaps I didn't find important to talk about. You might perhaps persuade me to talk about them by either asking me or discussing with me. Now, I propose to divide this short talk into two parts. First is the pre-independence period before Kenya got independence, and the second part will be after Kenya got independence, the post-independence period. Now, in the post-independence period, I'll be talking about the activism of my political activities while I was still in the country. And the second part of that post-independence period will be when I was living in exile, first in Tanzania and then in England, in London. And at the end of the talk, if we still have time, I thought that perhaps it would be nice to give this talk a poetic flavor. And if we have time, we'll end with a poem, which is one of the only four poems which I originally wrote in English, since I was told that this talk is supposed to be in English, so I just chose one of the poems in English. And this poem is called Peace, Love and Unity for Whom? We'll talk more about that later. Now, the pre-independence period. This period is the period, although my activism was mostly during the post-independence period, but the seeds of my political activism were planted before Kenya got independence. First, it was because of the political environment in which Kenya was. The struggle for independence, the racial discrimination which was there, the Mau Mau War of Liberation. I remember in those days when I was still young, I think I was about 5-6 years old, but I could hear on the radio when my great uncle, who brought me up, was listening to the news about this struggle, how many Mau Maus have been killed, by the British colonialists, and why were they fighting? So this had an impact on me, seeing that here are people who are fighting for the independence and dignity of our country and ourselves against the people who came and invaded us and took the country and made it their own and discriminated us in our own country. So, although I was very young at that time, but those seeds were planted in my heart. And that is partly because, again, apart from the political environment in Kenya itself, but the political environment at home, that I think also contributed a lot. As Wanakai was saying, I come from a family which has been very political for so many years, from the Portuguese period, in fact. We have been rebels throughout. So during the Portuguese period, there have been members of the family who are in the resistance against Portuguese. Then came the Arabs, again, from members from the family who are in that struggle against the Arab rule. And during the British rule as well, some of our members of the family were in there. Therefore, it was very natural for me, after independence, to be part of that. I took the baton and continued with the... But that home environment influenced me a lot. I could hear at home elders discussing these things about the injustices which were there during the Arab rule and again during the British rule. Now, then came the Mombao struggle on the eve of independence, when Kenya was about to get its independence, and when the Swahilis felt that they were being marginalized and being regarded as foreigners in their own country, Kenya, by upcountry people. That is perhaps a question which perhaps we could discuss further during the question and answer session. As I was telling Bwana Kai here, although the Swahilis have been complaining about that, but these Swahilis were partly responsible for them being regarded so by the upcountry people. We can discuss that further on. So during the independence, the Mambao struggle also, our home was vibrating with political talks. So there was no way, in fact, in short, that I could escape from being a political activist. Now, it doesn't necessarily follow that if you are in such an environment, you automatically become one. That environment can produce you to be one of them. But it was partly because I was myself interested in politics as well. Now, to the extent that during my school days, when we were still under British rule, the procedure then was that before you entered into your respective classrooms, you had to assemble, and at that time I was in primary school in Takaungu, it's a village in Kilifi district, north of Mombasa, about 30 miles north of Mombasa. We had to assemble in the playground and then to sing the national anthem, which was, of course, God Save the Queen. Now, because, again, of my political activism from that very early age, I was telling Barakaya, I was substituting the word queen with Kenyatta. Instead of God Save the Queen, I would say God Save Kenyatta. Because I believe that Kenyatta deserved that prayer more than the queen, because he was fighting for our country and for our people. Fortunately enough, there was only one student, my friend student, who knew about my seditious activity there on this. But fortunately enough, he didn't report me to the authorities. So you could see that from that very early age, I was already rebelling against the British system. Now, on the eve of independence, when Kenya was about to get independence, of course, many of us Kenyans had great hopes and expectations. We hoped that now the time has come, it's soon coming, that we will be able to rule ourselves, that all those kinds of injustices will be eradicated, Africans will start living in dignity and respect, and that Kenyans, irrespective of their either racial or tribal or religious affinities, will live as equal. There will be no discrimination of any sort. Also that there was hopes and beliefs that there will be equitable distribution of the national wealth of Kenya, that is the economic wealth, especially the land being the main issue. For those of you who know the history of Kenya and the struggle which was waged by the Mau Mau, you know that it was waged mainly because of the land question. When the people, their land was robbed from them forcefully by the British settlers, and they were dispossessed of their land, which was everything to them. Their lives depended on that. And in fact, instead the white settlers took the land. So there was this hope, great hope and expectation, that once independence comes, those who are dispossessed of the land, it will be given back to them. Now, if you look at the original KANU manifesto, KANU being the Kenya African National Union, which was the national party which waged the struggle, the political struggle for independence. If you look at the first manifesto, in the election manifesto of KANU, you'll see that the land question there, the way it was treated. I mean, if that policy was implemented, I think Kenya would not have gone through the difficulties which it went. But as we will see later, things didn't turn out that way. Now, after independence, especially just after 2 years after independence, disillusionments and disappointments starting to set in. Because here we had the ruling elite, the ruling class, who just yesterday were in the front line fighting for independence and telling people that everything is going to be okay and all the rights which the people had been dispossessed of will be given back to them and that we will live happily in our country. But just 2 years after that, the majority of those who were in power then, Kenyatta and his group, started to behave very differently. In fact, they started to misbehave. And they started to betray the struggle, the independence struggle. That is when the obscene amassing of wealth started, especially the land grabbing. The land which was taken from the people and by the settlers, that land, instead of being given back to the people, instead it was the leaders, those who were in power, who appropriated that land. And in fact, they became worse. Whereas the white settler perhaps owned maybe 100 acres or 200 acres of land, you had these politicians who were in power owning thousands and thousands of acres. So land grabbing of major proportions was starting to take place. Also, other economic ventures, companies, even independent companies, private companies. Some of the very successful companies, in fact, the owners, they, I mean, those who are in power found ways, mostly foul means of dispossessing those people. Those people built those companies, commercial entities, for a long time, but they found ways to of trying to look for excuses, legal excuses, to deport those people, and instead then appropriated their commercial concerns. So it was not only the land, but also other commercial and economic institutions and entities as well. Now, when I said that the ruling elite, I must emphasize that there were only some of them who were like that. But within it, there were some forces or individuals who were opposed to what was happening in the country. And these people who are also in the independence struggle. Now, among those was Oginga Odinga, Jaramogi Oginga Odinga, who is the father of the present Prime Minister of Kenya, Raila Odinga. Now, Jaramogi Oginga Odinga then was the first, was the Vice President of Kenya. And when he saw things going the way they were going, he and his other colleagues, for instance, Joseph Murumbi, Bildad Kagia, Chengo Neko, and the others, started to criticize from within the government. They were all ministers in the government. And they tried to steer the country away, or the leadership, away from this misbehavior. So they tried to change things from within. But of course the forces, the other forces, were stronger than them. They were few but very powerful group. And most of them were from the central province of Kenya. Because Kenya, for the first few years, in fact, was mainly dominated. It was only after Kenyatta's death in 1978, it was dominated by the people from central province. So they are the ones, in fact, who did most of the grabbing of the national wealth and the land. And it's, in fact, most of the land which was taken by the white settlers was from the central province, from their own people. But, and you can see the amount of greed which was there. They were taking this, denying their own people the land which belonged to them in the first place, instead of taking it to them. Now, Odinga and the others were trying to bring about these changes from within, insisting that we should go back to the original KANU manifesto and implement what is there. But that time, nobody wanted to listen. They had already tested the honey, and they didn't want to leave it. Now, for some 2 years, Odinga and his group tried to bring about these changes from within, but when they found that there was no way that they were going to succeed, because even constructive criticism was already started to be not to be listened to, they decided to leave the government. In fact, Oginga Odinga resigned from the government as a vice president and formed the first opposition party in Kenya, which was called Kenya People's Union. Now, Oginga Odinga, apart from the fact that he was here insisting that the government, or KANU government, should go back to its own manifesto, but Oginga, for those who know the history of Kenya and Odinga himself, was a person who had socialist leanings. And as a result, therefore, the Western world, or the Western countries, were very much against him. In fact, even him being appointed as the vice president, I remember the British government and the American government were so much put in so much pressure on the Kenyan government not to appoint him as the vice president. But then the relationship between Kenyatta and Odinga still very good, because the release of Kenyatta from detention was partly because of Odinga, the struggle he waged for the release of Jomo Kenyatta. To the extent, he went to the extent of that there was a time when the British government was ready to give Kenya independence. Odinga said, we don't want independence without Kenyatta. We want Kenyatta out of detention first, and then we talk about independence. So you can see how he respected Kenyatta. So because of that good relation they had, Kenyatta didn't listen to the pressures of the British government and the American government. So he appointed him as the vice president. So when he broke away from the party, he resigned from the government and the Kenya People's Union was formed. Of course, the policies of Kenya People's Union had socialist leanings. And it was more for social justice. KPU stood for social justice, not only the economic, but also the cultural and otherwise. Now, when KPU was formed, it was formed in April 1966. It had difficulty in establishing itself, especially I remember in those days, some of us who are trying to persuade people to join this opposition party, we really had time, because people were thought that we were just crazy. Here we are, independence, just three years after independence, and you want to start having opposition parties because of this independence euphoria. So we just got independence. Give this government time to establish itself instead of starting opposing it. I remember those days we used to tell people, I mean, if we allow this government to grow fat and stronger, it will be more difficult later on to change things. It's better start doing it now. Yeah? But many people didn't want to listen then. There were those who genuinely believed that it's too early for such opposition politics, and there were those who were benefiting from the system which was existing. So because of selfish interests, of course, they opposed that. Now, the opposition came mainly from the, of course, central province, but also from other parts of Kenya as well, especially those parts which had those people in power who were benefiting from the system. Now, immediately after KPU was formed in 1966, the Kenyan government passed a law in parliament. That law, it didn't take even 3 hours, because there was not even debate about it. It was passed. And that law was that all those who resigned from the government and from the ruling party and joined the opposition politics, meaning the members of parliament, the councillors and all that, the law said that they have to go back to the electorate to be re-elected. So they had to face elections again. Now, there were many members of parliament who had resigned from the ruling party, KANU, and left the government. Now, they went for re-election. Now, because the KPU had not had time yet to explain its policies to the people and to talk to the people, among more than about 63 members of parliament, only 9 members of parliament were returned to parliament, Odinga being one of them. Now, therefore, a lot of work had to be done in order to popularize the party and explain the party's policies to the people. But the government, after a while, after KPU started to do its work, now, although it was a registered party, legally registered opposition party, but the government didn't allow it to operate freely. It put so many obstacles on its way. By that time, you could not hold a public meeting in Kenya without first seeking a permit from the government, from the police. Now, many of the applications for the permits which were applied by the Kenya People's Union, KPU, were not granted, were not allowed. Its leaders were harassed, and its supporters. Some were started to be arrested already at that time. But with time, despite the obstacles and the difficulties, with time, people started to know more about the KPU and what it stood for. And therefore, people started to support it in great numbers. Now, in 1968, now KPU was formed in 1966, as I said, 2 years later, there was to be the first test of how the Kenyan populace felt about the government and about the opposition party. In 1968, there were local government elections. Now, in Germany, you call them what? This Serikali za Mitaa, Wahl, what? Kommunal, yeah, you know, Kommunal Wahl, yeah, Kommunal Wahl. Now, Kenya People's Union fielded candidates in all the constituencies. In total, there were about 1,800 KPU candidates who contested those elections. Now, by then, the people had already started to warm up to KPU, to the opposition party, and the government saw the writing, as so to speak, was on the wall for all to see that the government was going to lose these elections. Now, what the government did in order to prevent KPU to have strongholds in this and local elections, in fact, in my opinion, are more effective. There's more power in local government elections than in the national, in the parliament elections, because that's where things are done. Parliament is just a talk shop. There, I mean, I always believe that if you want to seize power, start from there. Forget about these parliamentary elections. Now, the government was going to lose those elections. What the government did, was it instructed the receiving officers. First of all, there they breached the law. In fact, the government breached its own laws. They appointed the district commissioners to be the returning officers in those elections. By law, civil servants are not allowed to participate in any party political activities, not even overseeing the elections. But the government instructed all the DCs all over the country to be returning officers, meaning that they were the ones who were supposed to be receiving the nomination forms of those all the candidates and making sure that those candidates participated or contested those elections. Now, a few weeks before the nomination day, the government assembled all these DCs in Nakuru, and they were given these instructions that they should make sure that no KPU candidate will be nominated to contest the elections. As a result, by the end of the day, all 1,800 KPU candidates were disqualified. And the reason given was that they did not fill their nomination forms correctly. Now, 1,800 people, not a single one of them. Now, even a stupid person, the most stupid person, won't accept that. As I said earlier, there was already suppression of the KPU activities. It could not hold its activities openly on the ground. As a result, the only way which was left for the KPU to have direct contact with the people, since political meetings were not granted permission, was to start underground activities. Now, part of those activities, underground activities, were to try to communicate with the people. One of the ways was to, through pamphlets, which were written and distributed secretly. I was about 19 years old then, but as I said earlier, I was already politically aware. And when KPU was formed, I was working as an accounts clerk in Mombasa Municipal Council, but I immediately became its supporter and member. Again, here, all the government, in the first instance, as I was explaining, it broke its own laws by appointing these district officers to be returning officers. Me, as an employee of the municipal council, I was not allowed to be a member of any political party, but I broke the law. I joined the party. And I was given, one of my tasks which was I was given in this underground activism was to write a pamphlet every month to explain the party's policies and sometimes to attack the government where we thought was doing wrong. I did this for some 6 months. So 6 pamphlets were written and distributed. Now, after the disqualification of these KPU candidates, 1,800 candidates by the government, I had to write another pamphlet, which the topic would be on these disqualifications. And this is the pamphlet which Manukai mentioned here, Kenya Twendapi, Kenya, where are we heading to? That pamphlet dwelt on these disqualifications. And in it, I started to explain that, in short, I'm just giving you a brief, very short brief on that. I started by saying that the only democratic and peaceful way of people changing the leadership in any country is through the ballot box, through the elections. It's a democratic right for the people. Now, since the government disqualified all these opposition party candidates, what it means is that the government has robbed the people of their rights to choose the leaders they want to be led by. And I tried to explain, give examples in different other places where the denial of this right by the government resulted into something very unpleasant. So a year after those elections, local government elections, we were supposed to have parliamentary elections in Kenya. So I said in that pamphlet, if the government will behave the same way in the parliamentary elections, denying and robbing the people their right of electing the people they want, the leaders they want, then the people will have no alternative except to change things by force, since the peaceful means are denied them. Now, that pamphlet was published and distributed. Just a few days after its distribution, I was arrested. Sorry.
Is that something that you all discussed before you made the pamphlet? Was there a meeting where you...
Right. Okay. Now, all those who are... Yeah, no, sorry, this is a valid question. All those who are knowledgeable about underground activities are not democratic. You cannot have underground activities democratically, especially if you are facing danger. You start democratize underground activities and you all be arrested. Underground activities by its nature are not democratic. So only few people would know about it. Now, yes, it was discussed, but very small group. Those the most trusted ones. Yes, we would meet and discuss what the topic should be, what the pamphlet should contain, and then it was left to me to draft. So I said that if the government behaves the same way in the parliamentary election, the people will have to rise up and remove this government by force of arms. I was arrested, as I said, and charged. I was facing 10 counts. I was sent before the court. I was arrested and remanded in custody for 3 months. And then my trial started. I was facing 10 counts. When the party and my relatives were looking for a lawyer to defend me, all the lawyers in town, in Mombasa, refused. Lawyers in Nairobi, those who approached, also refused. It's only later on we came to learn that they had been intimidated by the government not to defend. So here I was facing 10 counts of sedition. Among them was this about, I was agitating or instigating people to overthrow the government by force. Now, that offense in Kenyan law, you can get a death sentence for that. So here I was, knew nothing about the law. The lawyers refused to defend me. I had to defend myself. Now, what with? I was only left with common sense, which is not very common. Now, two of us were arrested. But the evidence against me was stronger than on the other, than on my colleague. Because he was arrested with the pamphlets themselves. He had not finished distributing them. Me, when I was arrested, they arrested me, in fact, at work at the Municipal Council in Mombasa. And then they took me to my flat and they searched the whole place, turned it upside down, took so many books, some of which were banned during those times in Kenya, but I had them, mostly from the Eastern Bloc. I made sure that the pamphlet was not at home, because I had already been warned. In fact, a week before my arrest, I had already got information that I was going to be arrested. One of our relatives was working with the special branch in Kenya. So, as they say, blood is thicker than water. He came and told me, you will be arrested. So if you want to flee the country, if you want to run, do it now. I said, no, I'm not going to run. I'm not going to run away. I'll run away till when? I'll wait here. So I made sure I'm at home that there was nothing to incriminating, you know. And I made sure that the pamphlet was not there and all that. I was so sure that it wasn't there. So when they came and searched my flat, they took those books, and I don't know whether I had forgotten it or they had it and they planted it there in order to get the evidence. Under the bed, they got one copy. And that was therefore the evidence. Now, but the main evidence came from somewhere else, not from Mombasa. It came from Takaungu, where the village where I went to school. Now, one of the activists, the KPU, underground activists, was from there. And he was responsible for distributing the pamphlets in that district there. Now, this person, we had done so many other very dangerous things before. He was steadfast. I don't know what happened to him this time. He betrayed me. In fact, he was the star witness, prosecution witness in my case. If it were not for him, the government didn't have any evidence apart from this pamphlet, which I could have made something out of it. But this evidence which he gave was so tight, there's no way I could wriggle out of it. But this other colleague of mine, there wasn't much evidence on him, apart from the fact that he was arrested with his bundle of pamphlets, but his explanation was that, well, I just found this bundle on the web, and since I collected all the newspapers and then to sell them to shopkeepers, because in those days most of the whatever you bought was wrapped in all the newspapers, and so I just kept them at home so that I could go and sell them to anyway, that helped. So, and my evidence, in my defense, I said, well, I had to own up. I didn't see any reason why the two of us should go to jail. I said that this thing was just me. Nobody else was involved. So they didn't have any evidence. He was acquitted. I went to jail. So, I said that I had to defend myself. 10 counts. Fortunately enough, they convicted me only on 3. I succeeded in 7 counts, to spell 7 counts, by the help of God. So I was sent to prison first for only 1.5 years on each count, but to run concurrently. Therefore, I was supposed to serve only 1.5 years. But then the Attorney General of Kenya, Charles Njonjo, appealed against the sentence. He says it was too inadequate. The charges were so serious. The judge erred in sentencing me only to 1.5. So I was sent back to the court, and they increased it to 3 years. Now, 3 years, again, I was supposed to have served only 2 years. By law, every prisoner gets 1/3 remission. So 3 years in prison, the sentence was 3 years. I was supposed to be in prison for only 2 years. But again, the Attorney General instructed the prison authorities that I should serve all those 3 years, and I should serve them in solitary confinement. So all those 3 years I was locked in a cell, no contact, not even with fellow prisoners. Because first I was kept in a block where it was called isolation block in committee. The committee maximum prison near Nairobi. It was a block which had about 18 cells, but there were only 3 prisoners in that cell. And we didn't see each other. We sometimes only could talk loudly, and we were not allowed to do that, but sometimes we did with the Lord. One of those prisoners was a very, very famous person in Zanzibar history, Field Marshal John Okello, the one who was said to be instrumental in the Zanzibar Revolution. He had been arrested in Kenyan prison because after the revolution there, after being expelled from Zanzibar and Tanzania, he went back to his country, Uganda. Kenya had also banned him from entering the country, but he found his way in there. He was arrested and he ended up in prison. So there were only 3 of us there. So I spent all those 3 years in solitary confinement, the first few months at this block, and then I was transferred to another block, which was any prisoner who was told that he was going to be transferred to that block, I think died several deaths before getting there, because it was the most brutal block. If you are sent there, you know, if you come back alive, you'll be so lucky. Now, I spent the rest of my imprisonment in that block. Many things happened there, mostly mental torture rather than physical, although sometimes they got physical as well, because that's where they broke one of my hip bone there. As a result, I have back problems from time to time. Kept in a very dark cell. I lost my sight there, in fact. It was a cell which I didn't know day from night. But I survived. Later on, I was transferred to another cell where at least there was light. And therefore, as a result, I managed to write these poems there. Now, to cut the story short about the prison, let's move on since... Oh, I've already... Sorry. I have to rush now.
Would you... Would you like to say something on the prison and the...
No, I think maybe they will come during question and answer. I think I should move to another phase now, so that we finish. We have more time for discussion. Now, after my release from prison, I stayed in Kenya for 3 months. I was released in March 1972. I was then 25 years old, because I went to prison when I was 22 years. I stayed in Kenya, not knowing what I was going to do, because I didn't even have the prospects of being employed there. Those times when you are known to be opposed to the government, nobody wanted to employ you. You were unemployable. But then, with God's grace, I was told about the vacancy which was at the Institute of Kiswahili Research, Dar es Salaam University, of a research assistant, research fellow. I applied and I got the job, and I moved to Tanzania, to Dar es Salaam. Now, those 3 months which I was in Kenya, I didn't keep quiet. After my release, I continued to criticize the government. And this time, a brother of mine, my elder brother, Sheikh Abdullahi, told me, you either have to keep quiet or you leave the country. Because this time, you won't come out of prison alive. Now, I should mention that this brother of mine, Sheikh Abdullahi Nasir, was very instrumental in sharpening my political awareness. He was in politics during the colonial period. In fact, he was one of the founding members of Kenya African National Union, KANU, the party which fought for independence and later on betrayed the people. But then after the Mwambao, after the coastal people started to feel that they were being discriminated against, and he was one of the spearheads of the Mwambao struggle. Again, as I said earlier, perhaps we can talk about that later on. Now, during the British rule, being a teenager myself, I was just like other teenagers in those days, especially in the early 60s. I was so much influenced by the Western culture, all this pop music and all that stuff, you know. Now, Sheikh Abdullahi, being a very traditionalist person, he was so angry with me that. But he used very tactical ways of trying to take me out of that influence. He didn't quarrel with me. What he did was he just made sure that most of the time we were together. As a result, therefore, he used to take me to his political meetings. He had already started to have his regular darsas, these religious lectures in mosques, which I attended also. Now, he also used to give me books to read, political books. And in fact, he's the one who instilled the love of books in me. Now, he used to give me these political books and tracts to read. And then there was a time when he gave me one book. That book was a book which completely changed me. From where I was, I went to the extreme left, to the extent that he was having difficulty now to bring me back to the center. And that book was History Will Absolve Me. It was a defense, Fidel Castro's defense, when they were arrested, when they tried the first attempt to overthrow the Batista government in Cuba, and they failed, and they were arrested and charged. And in his defense, as you know, You know how Castro likes to talk a lot. His speech is 2-3 hours. Political. So that defense was published in a book form. So he gave that book to me. And I vividly remember telling me, read this book and read it seriously. Now, when I finished that book, I went right to the left, extreme left. Therefore, when I was therefore active in KPU politics, I belonged to the left. And even there, I was telling when a guy this morning, even some of us young people then, when Odinga was for constitutional means of changing things, we young people, hot heads, we said, no, this is going to take ages. Let's do something when we finish this thing. Odinga said, no, as long as Mzee Jomo Kenyatta, although I don't agree with him, as long as he's alive, I cannot do such things. Right? But I was, you can see, I was completely to the extreme left. Anyway, so he told me that, well, you have to either keep quiet or leave the country. So when I got this job, I said, well, might as well perhaps save my skin. And so I went to Tanzania, and that was the start of my 22 years of exile. Because after that, I could not go back home for 22 years. Because in the confines of the university campus, I continued to criticize the Kenyan government. But of course, there now you had to be tactical. Now, for those who know the histories of our countries, our leaders did not tolerate criticism of their fellow leaders. So, if I had become more critical and more forceful, perhaps there was a danger that perhaps Nyerere would have asked me to leave the country and go and send me back to my country. But anyway, there in Tanzania, I did continue to criticize the government, but very low profile. It was after London when I finished my contract there in Dar es Salaam University, because I did 7 years, which was the maximum a non-Tanzanian could work. Yeah, that was the maximum period. So after 7 years, I had to leave the country. Although I was advised by some of the government authorities to take Tanzanian citizenship so that I could continue. But with Kenyan laws, if you take the citizenship of another country, you lose your own. And I didn't want that. It would have been very painful for me. So, but when I moved to London, especially after 1982 coup attempt in Kenya, when the military wanted to overthrow the Kenya government, but it failed, many people were arrested, many people were killed, many people were tortured, many people just disappeared, just like Latin American of the 70s. Up to now, nobody knows where they are. So we started to be active again there in London. Remember, me, Ngugi had come to London then to launch his new book, Decolonizing the Mind. And then the coup attempt took place there, and he was advised not to go back. So he was stranded in London. So when people were being arrested and killed, mostly university students and lecturers and teachers, just the five of us, Kenya, me, Ngugi, and another three Kenyans, we sat down and said, well, we have to do something. We cannot just sit idly by in this relative freedom here, and things are happening, bad things are happening back home. So first we started with the Committee for the Release of Political Prisoners in Kenya, which we formed in June 1982. But that committee was for everybody who was fighting for human rights in Kenya. You didn't have to be a Kenyan to be a member of that committee. And we needed the best. Therefore, most of the members of that committee were British citizens. We continued with that committee for 5 years, and then after 5 years, we started to form an external wing of the underground movement, Mwakenya, which we had, which was in the country, and which we called UKenya, and later on, it came to be United Movement for Democracy in Kenya. Now, our main task, in fact, in that movement was first to continue to support the struggle which was being waged inside, supplementing it. There were some things which those who were inside could not do, but we could, because we were outside And with time, we managed to succeed to lobby some of the Western governments to inform them about what was actually taking place, and especially the citizens of these countries, because the governments knew anyway what was happening. They just pretended they didn't because of their interests, commercial interests in Kenya. I was telling Banakai, it's only with the Scandinavian countries that we were most successful, because they didn't have much economic interest in Kenya. So they took action, they cut aid from Kenya because of that and all that stuff. So in London, we continued with these activities, and especially with the struggle for democratic Kenya for all these years. And I think I should stop here. Perhaps, as I said, later on we will have more during the question and answer. Now, if you allow me, I don't know if you do.
Yes, please.
As I promised, I think I would like to end with this poem now. Now, the background of this poem, Peace, Love, and Unity. Now, there's no Kenyan here, so you wouldn't know. Peace, Love, and Unity. Does it ring any bells?
The phrase
Peace, Love, and Unity.
It's on the currency, no?
No.
No.
Okay. Peace, Love, and Unity was... You must have the word Nyayo.
Mm-hmm.
Nyayo philosophy?
Yes.
So-called Nyayo philosophy. Now, Nyayo philosophy was President Moi's philosophy, which he came after when he took over the presidency after Kenyatta died in 1978.
In the footsteps.
Exactly. Nyayo, as Swahili students know, it means it has two meanings. The sole of your foot. Nyayo is plural. Wayo is singular. Wayo. We even have a saying in Swahili. Kununua ngombe wayo. If somebody is trying to sell you something without showing it to you, I said, unataka kuniuzia ngombe wayo. Okay. You're showing me the footstep, the footprint of a cow, and then you want me to buy this cow. I have to see the cow. Okay. So Nyayo is plural. Now, Moi, when he became president, he said in the very, very first speeches of his that he was going to follow Jomo Kenyatta's footsteps. Therefore, my philosophy is Nyayo philosophy. I'll be following, in other words, what he was saying was that things won't change. I'll continue with what Kenyatta had started. Now, and his interpretation of the Nyayo philosophy was that it's peace, love, and unity. That was the meaning of the Nyayo philosophy. Now, in our activities in London, when we were really giving Kenyan government problems there, they were so angry with us, they couldn't get at us, we were outside the country, they tried to lobby the British government to expel us from England because of our activities there, but give the devil his due. The British government refused. They said, these people have not broken any laws here. We cannot expel them. They're just telling the public, the Kenya they think they know. It's upon you, the government, to counter what they are saying. We cannot do anything. Now, but twice, a person came to me from the government to London to tell me that he has been sent by the government to try and persuade me not to continue with these activities. And that I should just say what I want from the government and it will be given to me, and that I will be allowed to go back home, because as I said, I had spent already 12 years, I think, without going back home. That will be allowed to go back home. Now, I told this person, I'm not interested in that. I'm not doing this. I didn't join this struggle for any material gain. I believe that something needs to be done, and I believe in what I'm doing. So I don't want any material reward from that. The only thing which will make me not continue with the struggle if things improve back home. So go back to the government and tell them I'm not interested. Now this poem, this is the background. Now in this poem I'm talking to Moi. as if I'm talking to Moina. So it's called Peace, Love, and Unity for Whom. Now the end of this poem, the last lines of the poem, are the first 10 verses of a chapter in the Quran, which talks about the Day of Judgment, when the sun is eclipsed, when the seas run dry, when the birds don't fly anymore, and what will happen to those who committed the sins here now. And so, sorry, as I said earlier, this is only one of the four poems only in my writing career which I wrote originally in English. As you know, all my other writings are in Kiswahili. And so you come and talk to me about peace, love, and unity, expecting me to agree, parroting your parody in my poetry, decorating your tyranny with bouquets of perfumed words and imagery to drive away the stench of your treachery and hoodwink humanity. I refuse. I refuse to enter my brain and ask it to entertain even the sound of the idea that our loves should entwine. Because what by love you define doesn't tally with mine. I love my heroes, you ignore, persecute, and kill. You love my enemies who rob and enslave me still. How then can there be love between you and me, when the beats of our hearts' music are not in harmony, when our hearts pump in and out different colors of blood? No, I refuse. I refuse to sing this song of submission and despair. I will instead forge my own words, which will cry out for my martyred heroes, past and present, whose blood and tears and death and toil gave life to the tree of the freedom of my soil. Those who always sought for freedom of speech and thought, and refused to bend or be bought. Those whose faith never waned to call for freedom to each and all. Whose courage was their shield, and with their spear of truth they fought and killed. Those who with their lives they swore that, come what may, onward they will go till their humanity they restore. Every day, every minute, I hear the bones and blood of my heroes declare there is a debt to square. Them we have not forgotten, them we will always honor and mention. With their memories we shall rekindle the fire, spreading its flames of wrath and ire to burn the roots of our oppression and uncover your every evil intention. How then can there be peace between us? How can there be peace between us when I'll never accept to bury the people's anger in the tomb of my verse? How can I forget decades and decades of my people's suffering and pain, of tears and blood pouring from their struggling limbs like rain? How can I ask them to sing your songs in high volume, to stifle the tormented sounds of those you torture and maim? How can I draw veils over their eyes to conceal and eclipse the sins of numerous massacres? I can still hear the echo of those dead proclaiming, our country, our wounded, mutilated country, where the dead are not dead and the living are not living. Our country, sculpted in fire and blood, where the north is barren and the south is hard. Our country, full of wrinkles and scars on your once beautiful face. Our country, in death, we still bleed for you, for we have decided to fear death less and decided to love death more. Because if by living we are dying, why then not die a little more so that we can live longer? Should I ignore these voices of these noble daughters and sons of my land? No, I refuse. For it is their unity I crave for. Shoulder to shoulder, arm in arm, we will go, not with you, whom we happen to know, that you take from a lamb and give to a lion more. You who has torn our house in two, ignoring the majority and favoring the few. But when the sun is darkened, when the stars fall and disperse, when the mountains are made to move away, when the camels, 10 months pregnant, are left untended, when the wild beasts are brought together, When the seas are set alight, when souls are paired, like with like, when the infant girl buried alive is asked, for what crime was she killed? When the records are laid open and the sky is stripped bare and there's nowhere to hide, you, who today judges, will be the accused. Okay, thank you.
Thank you very much, Chaplet.
Samahan sana.
Also for this incredibly powerful poem. I suggest perhaps we take a bit of breath.
Have a cake.
And everyone can take a piece of cake or a drink, and we reassemble sort of in 3 minutes, 3-5 minutes, yeah? And then have a question and answers. Again, it's been... again, fascinating to listen to you, and I'm sure lots of people in the round have a whole bunch of questions, and there's lots of things that we can pick up on. So I'll just take signs of hand, and we, yes, we'll spend some time on all kinds of questions and discussions. Okay, Lutz first, and please other hands if you just show me that you're
interested. I think we're
interested.
All quiet speakers, yeah, order?
No.
Sam is not. Okay.
Okay, so Lutz and then Sam. Yep.
Kwanza kabisa, niseme shukrani jazila. Thank you so much for this very, to me, very, very moving talk and very fascinating. And I think we also, apart from talking about your political struggle, we got a first impression of your poetic skills. And as I think almost all of us know, on Thursday you are invited again with our Baraza la Kiswahili here to hear more of your poetry in Kiswahili, and also to discuss the pamphlet Kenya Twendapi. So yeah, there are so many questions coming to my mind, so I just have to concentrate on maybe one or two. You were briefly mentioning when you were in England then. I was wondering how it was with the Kenyan government, whether still, maybe also the question is too personal, so of course if you think it's not adequate, you will just please tell us. Was it still a problem when already living in England that Kenyan authorities tried to follow you in some sort? And how were the British authorities then reacting to this?
Yeah, as I said earlier, since we were out of the country, there wasn't much the Kenyan government could do to us. The most they tried to do was to try and persuade the British government to expel us, especially me and Googie, because we were the mouthpiece of this struggle. We were the main speakers. So they tried that, the Kenyan government tried that, but they didn't. I remember during the government, it was Margaret Thatcher was in power. Now, there was a time when our campaign got stronger and hotter, and the government in Kenya was becoming angrier, more angry, that I was once called by the Scotland Yard because I was the chief coordinator of the movement there. I was called by the Scotland Yard, the special branch of... to be warned that they have information that some of the Kenyan security officers are around in London. And it seems that they have come to gather more information from you people. And we fear that perhaps they might cause you some harm, meaning us, who are active there. So the lady said, I've just called you here in order to advise you, and that through you, you advise your colleagues to take precautions. So he gave us a list of things not to do. For example, don't travel in your, don't use your cars. Use public transport because of danger of, instead of a bomb being planted, maybe. And even when you use public transport, when you are standing, maybe waiting for a bus or a tube, an underground, a tram, make sure that you don't stand near the road or near the pit where the tram is passing or the train is passing, for fear of perhaps of being pushed into being killed. Even when you meet, try not to meet in one place several times. It was different. So it was a list of things too. Mm. So yeah, they were trying to get at us. But as I said earlier, because again, when these are activities, when I had them doing them in London. Now, London, I'll admit that it's a free place. Then we shouldn't have had any worries about whether the government is going to know about what we are doing or our preparations, things like that. But still, because of our experiences back home in underground activities, some of us, those decisions were confined to a small group. Right? Only few of us knew exactly what was to be done, where to be done, when to be done. Even with meetings, when we meet, it would be the last minute when somebody would be informed that we are meeting somewhere. So in order to not give the enemy an advance warning to wait for us or plant devices there and then listen to what we are discussing there. So, as I said earlier, when we started with only five people. And even when we moved a stage further and formed this external wing of the movement, of the underground movement in Kenya, or Kenya, I remember in those days many Kenyans were criticizing us that we are not being democratic again, because we didn't give much information, we just did things without giving explanations, and it was on purpose. I mean, as I said, once you democratize the activity, the underground activities, you, even in London, some of the things had to be done quietly, secretly. And I was telling Wanakai again that among the Kenyan groups which were outside Kenya, because we were in London, but in every European country and some African countries, America as well, where Kenyans fled to, Kenyans grouped together there and formed some sort of an organization to continue the struggle back home. Now, our organization was among the very, very few indeed which were not infiltrated by the Kenyan government. Mm. Because of this, we kept things tight. We didn't democratize our activities. Those who democratized their activities, most of them ended up being kidnapped. Some of them were kidnapped from Uganda and taken back to Kenya. Some of them from Tanzania were expelled and sent back to Kenya. So we survived because of that. So yes, there was the government was trying to get at us, but there wasn't much they could do, really, being away from the country. Yeah.
Sami, yes.
Yeah, I also have a lot of thoughts and questions and relating to also just back home, and maybe a longer conversation about democratizing underground activities, because I wonder if you don't democratize, then once you reach power, are you then?
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, I'm sure you've had many discussions about that.
Mm-hmm.
So one of the things that I was listening to you talk and made me think, just the experience of prisoners in different contexts. It's almost like maybe you can flip the Marxist expression and say, prisoners of the world unite, just the experiences. But I wonder if at some point you're hardened or you get over the trauma because you've been in prison for so long. Because I've been to prison, but not for that long. Mm-hmm. And I think the short time that I was there, it was one night. So it's a question. A recommendation. I don't know if you've read this book. It's actually about the German resistance to the Nazis. It's a novel called Every Man Dies Alone. It's about the novel. I'm sure it's written in German, but it's translated. But it's actually it's a fantastic book. It just came out. It's about this underground movement, basically, of two people who pass out pamphlets, and so how they hide the pamphlets and so on, and you know, I don't want to give the whole story away, but your experience resonates very closely. I just want to come. I mean, I have many questions, but just one question to throw your way. I read an article by a year ago, and I've written an article that hopefully will be published. I quoted him because he talks about this idea between the difference between, and I was telling you, a revolutionary and activist. And Gugi says that the revolutionary, what was the revolutionary becomes then in the 90s and 2000s the political activist. He's this watered down version. Like an NGO activist, I see, I guess, partly the differences that in your experience, you worked through a political party, and there was, besides the individual identity of activists, it was some kind of group identity. And I was just wondering what you think of that and the transition from revolutionary to political activist, or how you see activism over 40 years, right, or 50 years, how that's changed.
I have difficulty in trying to separate the revolutionary from the activist. because a revolutionary is an activist. Political activist, and this term political activist, when it is used, most of the time you will find that it's not used for those who do not want to bring about change. The phrase political activist is mostly used for those who are struggling for change in any particular society. A revolutionary is the same, has the same goal. So I have difficulty there to separate these two. But if perhaps you mean by, especially when you said those during the independence, maybe those the revolutionary, and then after independence they became political activists.
Well, because I mean, maybe in English it's difficult. And I don't know if Ngugi was doing any kind of translating from Swahili, but in Arabic you have munadir or the hizbi, right? And then all of a sudden now you have nashit Nashat is the activist. Munadil is a person who struggles. I think the kinds of activities that the Nashat does today is very different than you don't consider, for example, someone in, let's say, in Lebanon and Hezbollah as a Nashat. You would say, they're a resistor. Right? And So I was just wondering if there's a change in the way activism has happened, you know, from 20 years ago till today.
Mm.
And maybe, you know, you said you at one point there was, you were exiled and then you were allowed to go back. And did that also change the way political activism? Mm.
No, I was not allowed to go back. I just went back.
Okay.
And I went back after Kenya, in 1994, that is, after Kenya reintroduced the multi-party system. It was in 1991, which, under the pressure, mostly mm-hmm. from the Western countries, and which was supplemented by the pressure from within. And then that time when America said that those countries, African countries, which don't want to democratize, they weren't going to receive any more aid. Yeah, so they didn't democratize because they believed in democracy, but because of these other things. Now, therefore, I just went there after the reintroduction of multi-party policy. And for the first time I went there, I stayed for only 1 week, and I was not sure. I just said that I'm going to test the waters and see how it feels. But I was okay because I kept a very low profile. I didn't talk. Even some journalists who knew me wanted to interview, they refused. So the first time I kept quiet. And I went there and felt very secretly. Again, this elder brother of mine was the only person who knew that I was going. Not even my mother knew that I was going, in order to keep it very safe. There's only one person from Tanzania, because I went by road from Dar es Salaam, a very close friend of ours, family friend. Knew that, and then in Kenya, my brother knew it. So it was, but then when it was okay, then the following year I went there again. But so far nothing has happened to me. But in the following year I started being vocal again. I took interviews, criticized, continued to contribute to the government, and so on and so forth. Now, if you, by your question, you mean that perhaps, and this is what I thought perhaps you meant, that perhaps those who were in the front line fighting for changes, when our countries perhaps were under foreign rule, colonial rule, be it British, Portuguese, French, and otherwise, and then after independence, those people, some of those people maybe became, I don't know whether you meant that, they became activists. And you mentioned the word NGO there. I would agree with you that if you compare the activism of pre-independence political activism and also post-independence political activism, especially immediately after independence, when people's hopes were betrayed and disillusioned, that type of activism was somewhat to continue with the struggle which was waged against the colonial powers. But now if you look at the activism now, and there the NGOs now come in, most of it, and this is one of the things which really saddens me, most of the political activism which is taking place in many of our countries nowadays, it's financed and guided by NGOs. To the extent that once the NGOs, for example, stop funding, no, there's no more. Nothing is happening. Now, that, I won't, that to me is not political activism as I know it. Because this type of political activism has been turned into business. Right? And I'm very much opposed to it. In fact, again, going back to our activities, one of the things we made very sure was that whatever we did has to come from our own resources. We didn't accept a single cent from anybody. One of the reasons is that we will only do things which we are capable of doing, which our resources can finance. Secondly, was that we didn't want to be controlled by anybody. Once somebody gives you his or her money, if you do things which is not in their interest, they'll just pull the rug and go nowhere. I was again this morning, yesterday, giving an example of the institute which we started in London. Me, King Moshe Shoye of Lesotho, and Abdurrahman Mohamed Babu was also instrumental in the Zanzibar Revolution, and later on became a minister in the Tanzanian government. Now, when America was pressurizing African governments to democratize, King Moshe Shoye, the king, now for those who know me, are surprised to hear that I was working with a king. I'm against monarchy. But this king was, if all the kings were like that, I wouldn't have a problem with kings, with monarchy. He was in London, he was in exile himself. That was his second exile, because he always fought with his government. He didn't agree with how his government was behaving. So they sent him into exile first to Sweden. That was London was second exile. So when America was pressurizing African governments to democratize, me, Abdurrahman Babu, and him, we go together. We said, okay, fine. We all want democracy, but not on American terms. We shouldn't just be forced to by the Western powers and external powers for their own interests, because it was not for Africa's interests mostly, this so-called democratization. So we started this institute, International Institute for Human Rights and Democracy in Africa. Now, you would have expected that since these Western governments want Africa to democratize, and part of the objective is to democracy in Africa, we would get some support from. But all the doors which we knocked, because our objectives were stated clearly, one of them was to resist pressure from outside. We will democratize, yes, but according to our own needs, according to our own history, according to our own aspirations, bearing in mind how each country was different, developed differently. You cannot just have a blanket democracy in all of them. Some of them have to take longer, perhaps, than others, if you really want democracy. Now, because of this fact that we said we are not going to, we're only going to do things according to what we see is right, not a single, all those funds, we had to finance it from our own pockets. Now, we didn't have that much money, of course, it didn't last long. We died, right? Because we held about some three conferences in London, one in Zanzibar as well, to try and mobilize all these democratic forces in Africa to continue.
What was this?
International Institute for Human Rights and Democracy.
When
Africa.
Was it?
That was in 1991. So, yes, I agree with you. Therefore, most of the political activism which is there now in Africa, not only in politics, but in other things as well, all these NGOs. Yes, it's more because there's money there rather than one is doing it out of conviction. And if you do something without conviction, this is all I always tell people, and especially young people who are in politics. I mean, if you don't believe in what you're doing, don't do it, please. Mm-hmm. Don't do it. You're just wasting your time. And again, this reminds me again of this elder brother of mine, who I told you about, when I was very active, after independence, this KPU in the opposition party's activities, especially when I wrote this Kenya Twendapo, because I had showed it to him. He was the first one who told me that this time they are going to arrest you. Change the tone in this pamphlet. I told him I'm not changing anything. It will be published as it is. Because it's so angry, because if you read the text, it's so angry. But during my activities, one day he called me and told me, you know what you are doing now is dangerous? I said, yes, I know it is dangerous. Do you know what will happen to you? I said, well, the most they will kill me or arrest me. Are you prepared for that? He asked me. Are you prepared for that? I said, well, I think I'm prepared. He said, well, okay then, this is my advice to you. If you are convinced of what you're doing, deep in your heart, and you don't have a doubt that once they start putting you into trouble, you're going to abandon all this. If you're sure, go. You have my blessing. Go forward. But even if you have an iota of doubt in your heart that once things start to get difficult, you are going to abandon, then abandon it now. And this is one of the things which helped me to go through whatever I went through in prison. When I remembered the promise I gave to this little black man who was my mentor, that kept me going. I had promised I will go on. So, if you don't believe in what you're doing, do only that which you believe in. If you don't believe, don't do it. You're going to suffer. And if I had regretted, I had strong convictions in what I did, the things I went through in prison, I think I wouldn't have come out either alive or sane. I would have been mad by now. That conviction acts like a balm. I don't know what's the German word. Bum. Bum is this thing which you perhaps...
Is it a buffer zone or bumper? Buffer zone.
No, there's
for the
this
car?
Type of thing which you, if you
it's
hurt yourself...
A protective...
Yeah, exactly. Body. You put it and then it soothes the pain. Mm-hmm. It doesn't... You don't feel the... Confusion can act like that. Confess so many things, but to say...
Thank you. Tobias, you had it?
I did. Yeah, I'm trying to. I have a bunch of questions, but there's no way that I can ask them. But
please do.
I mean, back when KANU won and took over power, and they learned from the colonialists and followed their example instead of the convictions that. Have you ever dreamed or envisioned what it would have looked like if they hadn't done that? And can you describe it?
If KANU had not diverted
from... Yeah, if they had done things properly, how would Kenya look today? Or do you think it could have even happened? What do you think?
I wish I could say that.
Just
because
a dream. Yeah.
I don't have a crystal ball.
Suspend your disbelief.
But one thing which I believe would have happened Kenya first is that at least people's lives would have been different. They would have been living lives as a human being should live, in dignity. Now, there's all, every time you hear this talk that Africa is poor, African countries are poor. Now, some countries perhaps might be. I believe Kenya is not a poor country. We have enough resources to allow Kenyans to live in dignity and not through hardship. But the problem is that what is there is in the hands of the few. And they don't want to let go of that. This example, one of the examples I told you about, the land. Including the president himself now, Kibaki, the amount of land which he owns, it can be a whole, it can be not a village, but a whole town. Whereas there are millions of people who don't even 1 acre of. Sometimes I say, what are you doing with all that wealth? So I think if they had not diverted from the original manifesto, things would have been different. Also, this repression which took place, especially from during Kenyatta's time after the KPU, that is, with all these people being killed, including their own ministers, who were Ouko and the others, who were seeing things differently, starting to question things, corruption and all that, I think there wouldn't have been that, those type of, so I think things would have been different. They would have not been perhaps as
utopia.
Utopia, yeah, exactly. as perfect as one would have liked to be, but I think things would have been would have been would
so
been
it's
different.
Kind of a lack of leadership or a lack
exactly,
of vision.
Exactly. That, right. Mm. Exactly. Exactly. Mm. And whoever emerged to try to bring about this vision and leadership and was not allowed to survive.
And maybe for a more positive vision, have you read Dambisa Moyo's book?
In fact, I just bought it recently. Yeah, I have a copy. I'm going to.
It's a very
dead
it's
edge.
Very
yeah.
optimistic and interesting
right.
vision
right.
for Africa without development aid.
Right.
Yeah.
Exactly.
It's called Dead Edge.
Dead Edge.
By Dambisa Moyo, a Zambian economist.
Mm-hmm.
If I may, I have a question, because you ended your poem, you alerted us to the fact, I don't know who of us would have noticed that it was with a quotation of the Quran that you ended that English poem on as a critique of Nyayo politics.
Right.
So I just wonder whether you could tell us a bit of whether and in which way Islam does and did play a role for you in during
as I said earlier, when I was intoxicated by the Western culture in my teens, how my elder brother was angry with that, and him being a Muslim scholar, he took me to his darsas, the mosque. Now, when I was trying to find my bearing and trying to come to terms with what was happening in the country, that I was not happy with things were, just like many young people of those times in the 60s, I wanted to know what the other side was saying, especially after now having my elder brother having succeeded in taking me out from this Western influence. So I wanted to want to know what the other side is saying about these problems which we are having here, meaning the Eastern side, the communist side. So I started reading a lot of communist books to the extent that I would have become a communist. Because when I read and how, now we know things are different from what they appear in the books there. But then we didn't know that. And when I saw how those problems were being dealt with in those books, in those complications, this is the thing for me. Because, as I said, looking for social justice. I couldn't find it in my own country, the government which we had there. System which we have. In my own religion, as we know, many of us are taught Quran just to read it without knowing what it means. But now, attending his lectures at mosque, because he was interpreting the Quran, that was his darsas, was the interpretation of the Quran. And I think maybe because of his political background again, because he didn't translate the Quran from the beginning to the end, he selected chapters in the Quran which were valid to what we were going through in the country, relevant.
Mm-hmm.
So most of it were dealt with economy, dealt with social justice and things like that. Now when I went there and listened to him translating the Quran, so these things are in here. I don't have to go far away to look for them. So that played a very big role. In fact, even if you read the Kenya Trinity, you'll see so many references about the Quran and about the and my other works as well. I said, it's here. And so yes, Islam did have a lot of influence on that. In fact, even when we were in London, remember when we were during our activities, as I said, we only did things which we knew that we could do, and we had the resources of doing them. Now, from one step to the other, we had to make sure that all of us are together in it. Now, I used to use a lot of what I learned in Islamic history in those activities. For example, if we wanted to do something which is more dangerous now, we would ask each other, are we all in it? Or there are some of us who perhaps feel, no, this is not, I cannot do this. Now, we gave each other allowance and permission. If you feel that, no, this is too dangerous for you, opt out. It's no shame in that. It's better to do that rather than go along with us and then later on you betray the cause.
Mm.
It's better. You have done whatever you have done, your contribution, fine. You cannot go further because this struggle, we didn't start it. It was started a long time ago. We're just continuing with what was started a long time. We will not finish the task, the job. It will be taken up by others. So if you can't go on to the next step, stay behind. Now, I took this from Islamic history again. In the battles which Prophet Muhammad's time, in each battle which he fought, before going further, he would ask, are we all together? Or are there some who perhaps who are tired now of this? Please leave. So that we know we are only 10 instead of thinking we are 100. Is it? We will fight as 10 people instead of relying on 100 people who are not there. So I use a lot of this in our activities. A lot of what I learned in Islamic history, we used to apply it there.
Yeah.
And,
Thank you. We have yes, I know. Yep.
Well, just a quick question. I was wondering what the connection between, because I don't know the Kenyan history, between the elites at the time of independence and the colonial past, so the British Empire, and so the leadership and so on.
Mm-hmm.
And if I understood correctly, also, your family is of an elite sort of background, or my because I was just wondering if that's the case, what the relationship between you and sort of people, other people, how that was.
No, I wouldn't regard our family as elitist, really. Not elitist in that sense.
You're not
a
king or a prince.
No,
your brother was part of
the
same party, right? So
I'm sorry?
Your brother was part of the same party of the ruling.
But then the KANU of them, when it was founded, it was a different KANU.
Okay.
It was a powerful struggle for independence. It was, and then it was hijacked later on by those. In fact, most who later ended up in government positions were not the original KANU members. These Moi, the president who took over after Kenyatta died, he was on the other side. He was opposed to early independence, Kenya's early independence, because it belonged to KADU, Kenya African Democratic Union. And KADU was formed by white settlers, formed and funded by them in order to bring about this unity among Africans. Right? Now, after their party was dissolved and joined the KANU, they are the ones who ended up being in government. So most of those original, apart from Kenyatta and a few others, the government up to now, in fact, is being run by those who are not in the original KANU.
The connection between the British and the ruling
elite.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. This is what I'm coming to. And this is what I was trying to differentiate between this, when you talk about elite. We're talking elite, you're being highly educated people, isn't it? We are not. It's from the family. Most of us are self-educated people. I always tell my students, the only formal education I had was 7 years, and I failed my primary school exam. And after that, I didn't go to school anymore. I just read books. My other brothers were just mostly self-educated, most of us. So we are not elite as such. It's just the thirst of knowledge. You just go and search for it. But coming back to that, there's a very valid point there. Because before independence, when the British government knew that it had to secede, to accede to independence, to Kenya, to give Kenya independence, they had prepared, did a lot of preparation. And this is not only in Kenya, but in other African countries as well. The colonialists didn't leave our countries before knowing that they have people who will continue with their work. Instead of them doing it directly, they will do it indirectly through our own people. And here I always refer students to those who are interested in politics to a book, The Wretched of the Earth, Franz Fanon. I don't know whether you've heard of him. In The Wretched of the Earth, there is a chapter there, I think it's called the Pitfalls of National Consciousness. I always refer students to that chapter. If you want to know how come Africa is in the mess it is in, read that chapter. Now, the colonials made sure that we are living physically, but we have people there to continue with that. Now, they educated few people, highly educated. And most of those who were educated ended up in government positions during colonial times as clerks, as whatever. So when we got independence, it was those people who had to run our governments. Now, with all those connections they had, and as I said, the colonists made sure that the strings were still there for them to pull. So they are the ones who are ruling the country, but with the blessings and with the orders and directions from somewhere else. And that's why you find that in all the ministries, especially those countries immediately after independence, in every ministry there were advisors from the Western countries. They were the ones, most of them, who charted the policies, economic policies, cultural policies, of the educational policies. We didn't do it ourselves. Now, one will ask, okay, you've got independence. We are partly to blame ourselves. We are independent. Why can't we change things now? But it was not. Those people are not placed. They knew that we are placing these people here. We trust them. They will do our work for us. So, yes, one of the problems we had is because of these elites. Because they were privileged people. Most of them were sons, and most of them, because it was mostly men, sons of chiefs, colonial chiefs. This Njonjo, I told you, the Attorney General was the son of one of the colonial chiefs there. Mbiu Koinange and the others. All of them ended up in those positions. And that's just continued. Because their families and their people did not contribute or participate in the struggle, in the Mau Mau, for instance, Mau Mau War. Now, when people talking about Mau Mau War, they said it was mostly mainly Kikuyu people from Central Province. But Central Province itself was divided. It was mostly people from Nyeri area who were in the struggle. The Kiambu, where Kenyatta came, they were not. They were on the opposing side. In fact, even Kenyatta himself, Kenyatta was just lucky because people needed a figurehead to spearhead the struggle. But Kenyatta himself, even when during the struggle, if you read a book called The Roots of the Revolt by Bildad Kabia, was one of the Mau Mau, he was in the independence, he was an assistant minister too. He's telling there clearly, from those days, they didn't trust him. There were certain things, decisions which were made, they excluded him. They didn't trust him. Because he had already shown some tendencies of a traitor. So it's only those who are privileged, from privileged families, who ended up being in government, and they messed things up. Those who were in the struggle were marginalized. And that's why, after independence, those who were fighting in the Mau Mau War in the forest, when they came out and found things have not changed that. Some of them went back to the forest. I said, this is not what we fought for. But then the Kenya government, the independent Kenya government, sent an army there and killed them all. Mm-hmm. Because they wanted to wage a second phase of the struggle.
I was just thinking, if one wanted a picture or a narrative or a story of this continuing struggle, I think Matigari by Ngugi's novel Matigari is a wonderful and quite brief novel, actually, which illustrates this, in a way, I suppose, the need for an ongoing struggle there, isn't it? Well, and I just wanted briefly to comment, because I may have evoked some wrong sense of elitism when in my introduction, because I referred to the family in a certain way. But no, I did want to clarify, because there's indeed the Kilindi, I mean, those are part of the so-called 12 tribes of Mombasa, which are, well, established genealogies of families that were at an early point in the 15th, 16th centuries, sort of building sort of the core political structure of the Mombasa old town. So in that sense, he's one, a member of this family, being able to trace, you know, the family genealogy back to them. But people of these families are not richer or you know, standing out in a sense that you would normally collect to elitism or elitists. Although, of course, you have this tradition, this intellectual tradition. So, you know, the scholarship and certain, you know, connections, perhaps, or these aspects of healing and poetry. So I just wanted to clarify on that point. And otherwise, I think we are at the point where we should now come to a conclusion. But so that you can all take something really with you, and three-dimensionally, we photocopied, we made a little handout of this article, with your permission. It was, after all, published 25 years ago in the magazine Africa Events, which Jilaj Abdallah actually ran and contributed to as an editor and writer. And it is extracts. Is it the only remaining sort of, right? Because your diary, your prison diary, if I got you right, was lost.
Because when I was in prison, I wasn't allowed any reading or writing material.
Yes.
In fact, the book, poems, this book from Jadiki, was written on toilet paper.
Yeah.
I was not allowed any reading or writing material, and it was the help of one of the warders, my permanent warders, who were guarding me there, who became a friend. There were two of them who became friends to me, because they subscribed to my political ideas, and also we became friends. They were not very harsh to me. And it was one of them whom I asked, he sent me a small piece of pencil, which is the one which I used to. Now, every week I used to be given a ration of toilet papers. Mm-hmm. But since I didn't use, I use water, I don't use toilet paper. I used those as my writing material. So I wrote. And then one of these warders used to smuggle the poems out and send them to my elder brother. This is the elder brother of mine, Abdullah Anas, who kept them safely till when I was released, and then it was published in a book. Now, the diary, now there were, I don't have to get into, because we don't have time anymore. It was painstaking, I mean, to preserve what I had written before that warder came. So that I could give it to him and smuggle them out. There was so many things that had to happen to hide those things.
Mm.
Now, but anyway, the diary which I kept, I used secret language, because every single day, every morning, they would come into my cell and search my cell. Now, I didn't have anything in my cell apart from the chamber pot as my lavatory, as a toilet, and my plastic mug, glass, and my two blankets, which was my bed, and the clothes I was wearing. But still, even then, every morning they would come and search the cell, and I had to strip off, open my mouth, so that in case I've eaten anything into the mouth and things like that. I had to bend down to look into my back, if I have eaten anything at the back and things like that. But still, I managed to hide those things in my own ways. So the language which I used to keep this diary was a secret language in codes.
Great.
Now, after I came out with coded language, I mean, if you don't work on it after a while, you forget. You forget yourself what you have written. You cannot decipher it anymore. Now, I couldn't, when I went through it, because it's still in London, it's one of the papers which are still in London.
Yep.
But I cannot do anything to it now. I've forgotten everything, most of the things which I've done. Yeah. It's only these things which I, these days I could still remember.
Okay.
So it's only this part of it.
Okay, so these are the remaining deciphered.
Deciphered the thing. The other that's not, yes. Unfortunately.
You might be able to give it to a linguist. And they, you know, because they might have be able to trace the pattern of
inshallah.
Language again.
Okay.
So this is only what I could still remember.
Yeah. Okay, well, in any case, I would like to thank you very much once again. This was really quite extraordinary, I think. And, for all of you who would like to either stick around a little bit to ask direct questions informally, or join us for in a little while. We'll go out for dinner near the S-Bahn station. So if anyone would like to join in, you're all very welcome. And just let me
know.
The Thai
restaurant, isn't it?
I think the Thai restaurant would be good. No, it's